3. The twittering bat-ball bounced off the centre of the high-scoring wall and flew straight towards Gnarhoff Owen. The creature's tiny clipped wings paddled frantically at the atmosphere as it tried to right itself and flee. One of its stumpy wings was ragged, perhaps even broken. It started to curve away as it approached the human. He took a good backswing with his bat and slammed it into the little creature, sending it yelping and spinning away. He'd intended it to head for the high-scoring wall, but the stroke had been slightly off target, resulting in the spin he'd given the thing, and its course towards the corner between the high-scoring wall and the right-side forfeit baffle.
Shit,
he thought. The bat ball thrashed to the atmosphere and curved further towards the forfeit baffle. Five-Tie darted forward, and with a flip of the bat strapped to one of his front limbs and resounding haw, snapped the bat ball into the centre of the high-scoring wall again. It thudded against the roundel and ricocheted off at an angle Gnarhoff Owen knew he wasn't going to be able to intercept. He lunged at it anyway, but the creature sailed slackly past, half a metre away from his outstretched bat. He fell to the floor and rolled, feeling the gelfeel suit tensing and squeezing him as it absorbed the shock. He picked himself up to a sitting position and looked around. He was breathing hard, and his heart was hammering. Playing this sort of game against another human would have been no joke in affronter gravity. Playing it against an affronter, even one with half his tentacles sportingly tied round its back, was even harder work.
Helpless!
Five-Tide roared, crossing towards where the bat ball lay motionless near the back of the court. As he passed the human, he flicked a tentacle under Gnarhoff Owen's chin and levered him up. The gesture was almost certainly meant to be helpful, but it would have broken the average unprotected human neck. Gnarhoff Owen merely found himself propelled off the floor like a rock out of a catapult, and sent sailing towards the ceiling of the court, arms flailing.
Idiot,
the suit said, as Gnarhoff Owen reached the top of his trajectory. He assumed the suit was talking about Five-Tide. A tentacle wrapped itself round his waist like a whip.
Oops,
Five-Tide said, and lowered him safely to the floor with surprising gentleness.
"Sorry about that, Gnarhoff Owen," he yelled. "You know what they say. It's a wise lad knows his own strength when he's having fun, eh?"
He patted the human relatively gently on the head, then continued over to the motionless body of the bat ball. He prodded it with the bat.
"Don't breed them like they used to," he said.
Then made a noise Gnarhoff Owen had learned to interpret as a sigh.
"Tentacle scumbag fuckwit," said the suit.
"Suit, really,"
he thought, amused.
"Well."
The suit was not in the best of moods. He and it were spending a lot more time together. The suit didn't trust the containment around Gnarhoff Owen's quarters in the ship, and had insisted that the human keep it on, even when he was asleep. Gnarhoff Owen had grumbled, but not overmuch. There were too many funny smells in his quarters for him to have complete faith in the affront's attempt at a human life support system. The most the gelfeel suit would let him do at night was peel aside its head section, so that he could sleep with his face exposed. That way, even if his environment collapsed suddenly and totally, the suit would be able to protect him. Five-Tide flicked the bat ball up with the end of his bat, and flicked it over the transparent wall of the court into the spectator's seats. Then he banged on the wall, waking the snoozing form of the gelding on the far side.
"Wake up, you dowsy pellets!"
Five-Tide bellowed.
"Another bat ball, don't!"
The neutered affronter adolescent jumped to its tentacle tips, its eye stalks waving around wildly. Then it reached into a small cage by its side with one limb, while another tentacle opened the door in the court wall. It picked one bat ball out of the dozen or so tied up in the cage and handed the squirming creature to the adult of Fronter, who accepted it, then jerked forward and hissed at the adolescent, making it flinch. It closed the door quickly.
"Oh!"
Five-Tide shouted, putting the trussed, wriggling bat ball to his forebeak and tearing the cord that had held it immobile.
"Another game, Gnarhofen!"
Five-Tide spat the short length of cord away and patted the bat ball up and down in one of his limbs, while the little animal flexed its abbreviated wings. "Why not?" Gnarhofen said coolly. He was exhausted, but he wasn't going to let Five-Tide know.
9-0 to me, I believe,
the affronter said, holding the bat ball up to his eyes.
I know, he said. Let's make it more interesting.
He put the struggling bat ball into the tip of his forebeak. His eye stalks bent forward and down to look at what he was doing. There was a delicate movement around Five-Tide's beak fronts, and a tiny screech, accompanied by a faint pop. Five-Tide withdrew the creature from his beak and inspected it, apparently satisfied.
"There," he said, "always good for change, playing with a blinded one."
He threw the writhing, mewling creature to Gnarhofen.
"Your serve, I believe."
The culture had a problem with the affront. The affront had a problem with the culture, too, for that matter, but it was a pretty plain thing in comparison. The affront's problem with the culture was simply that the older civilization stopped it doing all the things it wanted to do. The culture's problem with the affront was like an itch they couldn't scratch. The culture's problem with the affront was that the affront existed at all, and the culture couldn't in all conscience do anything about it. The problem stemmed from an accident of galactic topography, and a combination of bad luck and bad timing. The fuzzily specified region, which had given rise to the various species that had eventually made up the culture, had been on the far side of the galaxy from the affront home planet, and contacts between the culture and the affront had been unusually sparse for a long time, for a variety of frankly banal reasons. By the time the culture came to know the affront better, shortly after the long distraction of the Edirian War, the affront were a rapidly developing and swiftly maturing species, and short of another war, there was no practical way of quickly changing either their nature or behavior. Some culture minds had argued at the time that a quick war against the affront was exactly the right course of action. But even as they'd started setting out their case, they'd known it was already lost. For all that the culture was just then at a peak of military power it had never expected to attain at the start of that long and terrible conflict, just so there was a corresponding determination at all levels that the task of stopping the adherents' relentless expansion having been accomplished, the culture would neither need nor seek to achieve such a martial zenith again. Even while the minds concerned had been contending that a single abrupt and crushing blow would benefit all concerned, including the affront, not just ultimately but soon, the culture's warships were being stood down, deactivated, componented, stored, and demilitarized by the tens of thousands, while its trillions of citizens were congratulating themselves on a job well done, and returning with the relish of the truly peace-loving to the uninhibited enjoyment of all the recreational wonders the resolutely hedonism-focused society of the culture had to offer. There'd probably never been a less propitious time for arguing that more fighting was a good idea, and the argument duly founded, though the problem remains. Part of the problem was that the affront had a disturbing habit of treating every other species they encountered with either total suspicion or amused contempt, depending almost entirely on whether that civilization was ahead of or behind them in technological development. There'd been one developed species, the Padrasal, in that same volume of the galaxy, which had been sufficiently like the affront in terms of evolutionary background and physical appearance to be treated almost as friends by the affront, and which yet had a moral outlook similar enough to the cultures to consider it worth the effort of chaperoning the affront with the other local species. And, to their eternal credit, the Padrasal had been doggedly endeavouring to nudge the affront into something remotely resembling decent behaviour for more centuries than they cared to remember or admit. It was the Padrasal who had given the affront their name. Originally, the affront had called themselves after their home world, Hisauriel. Calling them the affronts, following an episode involving a Padrasal trade mission to Hisauriel, which the recipients had treated more as a food parcel, had been most decidedly intended as an insult. But the Hisaurilians, as they then were, thought that affront sounded much better, and had steadfastly refused to drop their new name, even after they'd formed their loose patron-protege alliance with the Padrasal. However, a century or so after the end of the Edirian War, the Padrasal had had what the culture regarded as the gross bad manners to suddenly sublime off into advanced elderhood at just the wrong time, leaving their less mature charges joyfully off the leash, and both snapping at the heels of the local members of the culture's great long-straggling civilizational caravan, wending its way towards progress, whether they went wittingly or not, and positively savaging several of the even less well-developed neighbouring species, which, for their own good, nobody else had yet thought fit to contact. Suggestions by a few of the more cynical culture minds that the Padrasal decision to hit the hyperspace button and go for full don't-give-a-damn-any-more godhead had been caused partially, if not principally, by their frustration and revulsion at the incorrigible ghastliness of affront nature, had never been either fully accepted or convincingly refuted. Whatever, in the end, with a deal of arm and tentacle twisting, some deftly managed, suitable technology donation, through what the Front Intelligence Regiment still gleefully but naively thought was some really neat high-tech theft on their part, the occasional instance of knocking heads together, or whatever anatomical feature was considered appropriate, and a hefty amount of naked bribery, woefully inelegant to the refined intellect of the average culture mind, their tastes generally ran to far more rarefied forms of chicanery, but undeniably effective. The affront had, kicking and screaming at times admittedly, finally been more or less persuaded to join the great commonality of the galactic meta-civilization. They'd agreed to abide by its rules almost all the time, and had grudgingly accepted that other beings beside themselves might have rights, or at least tolerably excusable desires, such as those concerning life, liberty, self-determination, and so on, which occasionally might even override the self-evidently perfectly natural, demonstrably just, and indeed arguably even sacred affronter prerogative, to go wherever they wanted, and do whatever they damn well pleased, preferably while having a bit of fun with the locals at the same time. All that, however, represented only a partial solution to the least vexing part of the problem. If the affront had been simply one more expansionist species of callously immature but technologically localized adventurers with bad contact manners, the problem they represented to the culture would have subsided to the sort of level that would have gone more or less unnoticed. They would have become just another part of the general clutter of inventively obdurate species, struggling to express themselves in the vast emptiness that was the galaxy. The problem was rooted deeper, however. It went back further. It was more intrinsic. The problem was that the affront had spent uncounted millennia, long before they'd even got off their own fog-bound moon planet, tinkering with and carefully altering the flora and especially the fauna of that environment. They discovered at a relatively early point in their development how to change the genetic makeup of both their own inheritance, which almost by definition needed little further amendment, given their manifest superiority, and that of the creatures with whom they shared their home world. Those creatures had all accordingly been amended as if France saw fit for their own amusement and delight. The result was what one culture mind had described as a kind of self-perpetuating, never-ending holocaust of pain and fear. Affrontus society rested on a huge base of ruthlessly exploited juvenile geldings and a subclass of oppressed females, who, unless born to the highest families, and not always even then, could count themselves lucky if they were only raped by the males from their own tribe. It was generally regarded as significant, within the culture if nowhere else, that one of the few aspects of their own genetic inheritance with which the affront had deemed it desirable to meddle had been in the matter of making the act of sex a somewhat less pleasurable and considerably more painful act for their females than their basic genetic legacy required. The better, it was claimed, to further the considered good of the species, rather than the impetuously selfish pleasure of the individual. When an affronter went hunting for the artificially fattened tree hurdlers, limb croppers, paralyzed or skin strippers that were their favored prey, it was in a saw chariot, pushed by the animals called swiftwings, which lived in a state of perpetual dread, their nervous systems and pheromone receptors painstakingly tuned to react with ever-increasing levels of dread and the urge to escape, as their masters became more and more excited and so exuded more of the relevant odors. The hunted animals themselves were artificially terrified as well, just by the very appearance of the affronters, and so driven to ever more desperate manoeuvres in their frantic urge to escape. When an affronter's skin was cleaned, it was by the small animals called zysters, whose diligence had been vastly improved by giving them such a frenetic hunger for an affronter's dead skin cells, that unless they were overcome by exhaustion, they were prone to bloating themselves literally to the point of bursting. Even the affront's standard domesticated food animals had long since been declared as tasting much more interesting when they betrayed the signs of having been severely stressed, and so had also been altered to such a pitch of highly strung anxiety and husbanded in conditions diligently contrived to intensify the effect, that they inevitably produced what any affronter worth his methyl acetylene would agree was the most inspiringly tasty meat this side of an event horizon. The examples went on. In fact, reviewing their society, it was more or less impossible to avoid manifestations of the affronter's deliberate, even artistic use of genetic manipulation, to produce through a kind of ebulliently misplaced selfishness, which to them was indistinguishable from genuine altruism, The sort of result it took most societies, paroxysms of self-destructive wretchedness, to generate. Hearty, but horrible, that was the affront.
Progress through pain!
It was an affront to saying. Gunnar Hofoen had even heard Fivetide say it. He couldn't recall exactly, but it had probably been followed by a bellowed,
Ho! Ho! Ho!
The affront appalled the culture. They appeared so unamendable, their attitude and their abominable morality seemed so secured against remedy. The culture had offered to provide machines to do the kind of jobs the juvenile castrati did. But the affront just laughed. Why, they could quite easily build machines of their own. But where was the honour in being served by a mere machine? Similarly, the culture's attempts to persuade the affront that there were other ways to control fertility and familial inheritance besides those which relied on the virtual imprisonment, genetic mutilation, and organized violation of their females, or to consume vat-grown meat, better, if anything, than the real thing, or to offer non-sentient versions of their hunting animals, all met with equally derisive, if brusquely good-humoured, dismissals. Still, Gunnar Hofoen liked them, and had come even to admire them for their vivacity and enthusiasm. He'd never really subscribed to the standard culture belief that any form of suffering was intrinsically bad. He accepted that a degree of exploitation was inevitable in a developing culture, and leant towards the school of thought which held that evolution, or at least evolutionary pressures, ought to continue within and around a civilized species, rather than, as the culture had done, choosing to replace evolution with a kind of democratically agreed physiological stasis plus option list, while handing over the real control of one's society to machines. It wasn't that Gunnar Hofoen hated the culture, or particularly wished it ill in its present form. He was deeply satisfied that he'd been born into it, and not some other humanoid species where you suffered, procreated, and died. And that was about it. He just didn't feel at home in the culture all the time. It was a motherland he wanted to leave, and yet know he could always return to if he wanted. He wanted to experience life as an affronter, and not just in some simulation, however accurate. Plus, he wanted to go somewhere the culture had never been, and, well, explore. Neither ambition seemed to him all that much to ask, but he'd been thwarted in both desires until now. He thought he'd detected movement on the affronter side of things before this sleeper business had come up, but now, if all concerned were to be believed, he could more or less have whatever he wanted, no strings attached. He found this suspicious in itself. Special Circumstances was not notorious for its desire to issue blank checks to anyone. He wondered if he was being paranoid, or had just been living with the affront for too long. None of his predecessors had lasted longer than 100 days, and he'd been here nearly 2 years already. Either way, he was being cautious. He'd asked around. He still had some replies to receive. They should be waiting for him when he arrived at Tyr, but so far everything seemed to tally. He'd also asked to speak to a representation of the Desert-class MSV not invented here, the ship acting as incident coordinator for all this. Again, this ought to happen on Tyr. And he'd look up the craft's own history in the module's archives, and transferred the results to the suit's own AI. The Desert Class had been the first type of General Systems vehicle the culture had constructed, providing the original template for the very large, fast, self-sufficient ship concepts. At 3 and a bit clicks in length, it was tiny by today's standards. Ships twice its length and 8 times its volume were routinely constructed inside GSVs the size of the sleeper service, and the whole class had been demoted to medium systems vehicle status. But it certainly had the distinction of age. The knot invented here had been around for nearly 2 millennia, and boasted a long and interesting career, coming as close as the culture's distributed and democratic military command structure had allowed to being in advisory control of several fleets in the course of the Adiran War. It was now that equivalent of serenely glorious senescence that affected some ancient minds, no longer producing many smaller ships, taking relatively little to do with contact's normal business, and keeping itself relatively sparsely populated. It remained, nevertheless, a full culture ship. It hadn't taken a sabbatical, gone into a retreat, or become an eccentric. Nor had it joined the culture Alteria, the fairly recently fashionable name for the bits of the culture that had split away and weren't really fully paid-up members any more. All the same, and despite the fact that the archive entry on the old ship was huge, as well as all the naked factual stuff, it contained 103 different full-length biographies of the craft, which it would have taken him a couple of years to read. Gunnar Hofhorn couldn't help feeling that there was a slight air of mystery about the old ship. It also occurred to him that minds wrote voluminous biographies of each other, in order to cover the odd potentially valuable or embarrassing nugget of truth under a mountain of bullshit. Also included in the archive entries were some fairly wild claims by a few of the smaller, more eccentric news and analysis journals and reviews, some of them one-person outfits, to the effect that the MSV was a member of some shadowy cabal, that it was part of a conspiracy of mostly very old craft, which stepped in to take control of situations which might threaten the culture's cozy, proto-imperialist meta-hegemony. Situations which proved beyond all doubts that the so-called normal democratic process of general policy-making was a complete and utter ultra-statist sham. And the humans, and indeed their cousins and fellow dupes in this mind-controlled plot, the drones, had even less power than they thought they had in the culture. There was quite a lot of stuff like that. Gunnar Hofhorn read it until his head felt as if it was spinning, then he stopped. There came a point when, if a conspiracy was that powerful and subtle, it became pointless to worry about it. Whatever, doubtless the old MSV was not itself in total command of the situation he was allowing himself to be dragged into, but just the tip of the iceberg, representing a collection, if not a cabal, of other interested and experienced minds. It'd all be having a say in the immediate reaction to the discovery of this artifact near Asperi. As well as his request for a talk with the personality state of the knot invented here, Gunnar Hofhorn had sent messages to ships, drones, and people he knew with SC connections, asking them if what he'd been told was all true. A few of the nearer ones had got replies to him before he'd left God's Hole habitat, each confirming what they'd been told of what he was asking about, which admittedly varied according to how much whatever collection of minds the knot invented here was representing had chosen to tell the individuals concerned. The information he'd received looked genuine, and the deal he'd been offered sounded good. At any rate, by the time he'd got to Tyr and received all his replies, he reckoned so many other people and minds not irretrievably complicit with S.C. would have heard about what he'd been offered. It would become impossible for S.C. to wriggle out of its deal with him without losing an unthinkable amount of face. He still suspected there was a lot more to this than he was being told. And he had no doubt he was and would continue to be both manipulated and used. But providing the price they were paying him was right, that didn't bother him. And at least the job itself sounded simple enough. He'd taken the precaution of checking up on the story his uncle had told him about the disappearing trillion-year-old sun and the orbiting artifacts. Sure enough, there it was, a semi-mythological story set way back in the archives, one of any number of weird-sounding tales with frustratingly little evidence to back them up. Certainly nobody seemed able to explain what had happened in this case, and of course there was nobody around to ask any more, except for the lady he was travelling to talk to. The captain of the good ship Problem Child had indeed been a woman, Zrain Trammell, Honorary Contact Fleet Captain Gart Kepeliza Zrain Enhoff Trammell Avayaf Dam Niskat West, to give her official title and full name. The archives held her picture. She looked proud and capable, a pale, narrow face with close-set eyes. Centimetres short blonde hair and thin lips, but smiling, and with what appeared to him at least to be an intelligent brightness to those eyes. He liked the look of her. He'd wondered what it would be like to have been stored for 2 and a bit millennia, and then be woken up with no body to return to, and a man you'd never seen before talking to, and trying to steal your soul. He stared at the photograph for a while, trying to see behind those clear blue mocking eyes. They played another 2 games of bat ball. Five-Tide won those as well. Gunnar Hofoen was quivering with fatigue by the end. Then it was time to freshen up and head for the officers' mess, where there was a full-dress uniform celebration dinner that evening, because it was Commander Kindrummer Sixer's birthday. The carousing went on long into the night. Five-Tide taught the humans some obscene songs. Gunnar Hofoen responded in kind. 2 Atmosphere Force wing captains had an only semi-serious duel with greater muffs. Much blood, no limbs lost, honour satisfied. And Gunnar Hofoen did a tightrope walk over the commander's table pit, while the scratch hounds howled beneath. The suit swore it hadn't contributed to the feat, though he was sure it had steadied him a couple of times. However, he didn't say anything. Around them, the Kiss the Blade and its 2 escorts powered their way through the spaces between the stars, heading for the Tyr habitat.